I really enjoyed being here with you this weekend. It's a beautiful place, and there's a great feeling here. And it was certainly part of the meeting that you had last night here. That sense of camaraderie and the unity that is here. There really was, I was thinking as I sat there with you listening that this sense of the feeling amongst passengers of an ocean-going liner moments after rescue from shipwreck was in the room. We are clearly all here by God's grace. A guy told me one time that you have to qualify for God's grace, which was kind of startling to me when I first heard it. And then he said, in order to qualify for God's grace, you have to be a liar and a cheat and a thief. And I thought, well, I qualify. Maybe there's some people that don't need God's grace. I need God's grace. I need it desperately. I have always known that you get back what you put out. That concept didn't startle me when I was told that a long time ago, that what's coming in is going out, basically. We feel like we don't like what's happening to us. We can be sure that the law of exchange has, we have put it out there. We've put it out into the universe. And particularly things like our withholds. We bitch and moan and carry on because the universe withholds from us. I'm not getting the respect I want. I'm not getting the income I want. I'm not getting the love that I want. I'm not getting the freedom that I want. But it's always attached to some withhold that I have going on in my life. For so long, I withheld love because I didn't. I'm gonna love you when I get the love that I should have gotten as a kid. Until then, no. And I didn't really think that through, and I certainly never said it out loud. But that was basically my withhold. I'd like to love you, but I didn't get the love I needed as a kid. And there's not enough, I just don't have any. I don't have any to share. And when I began to see that, and was told, really, that if I could take a huge chance and give the love I never got, that things would shift for me, that the universe would reward me abundantly with that. And when we're working, and we all have those backgrounds, or we work with people that have those backgrounds where their early life was just a shambles, and it's almost inevitable that they're going to come to us with this feeling that I don't dare give away any love. I just don't, because I didn't get my share when I was a kid. And what little sense of love I have, I cannot. And if we're really living this life with the grace that we've been given so richly, the idea of being the bottleneck for the love that's come into our lives is really limiting to us. It's very limiting. It's the kind of thing that makes it impossible for me to be the garden hose that I'm supposed to be. And that's really what it is. I mean, there's a lot of flowers that need watering. And my job is to be the garden hose. And they're beautiful flowers. They don't look like it. They're a little bit withered, sometimes. But we can make a difference. We can make a difference. Not by anything that we do so much, but who we are. Who we are. And as we go back out of here today, I always like to remember in leaving one of these that this coming together that we have enjoyed so much, that has so enriched me, has so blessed Gary, who I love so much, carries with it a responsibility of going back into our AA meetings, making sure that we simply carry this and not so much talk about it. We've picked up some information, we have gained some insight, we have been blessed by our togetherness, and if I can take that back and be loving and kind and generous of heart to the people that I'm going to see in my AA meetings. That's what I want to be. I want to be the garden hose, because I'll get all the water I need if it's coming through me. If it's coming through me. I get all that and more and more. But if I go back there with an attitude that now I'm better, I'm a better AA, for some reason I've got an edge, I've got a little bit of a jump on you, nothing good comes of that. And I can't keep whatever I've gained here. If we go back into our homes and don't make sure our wives and children are glad that we were here this weekend, we're missing a bet. I can go back into that home and how come these dishes aren't done is one way to open up the conversation. But that won't take me where I want to go, boy, I'll tell you that. It doesn't take me home. I can walk in the house and jump in and clean that kitchen up, you know. Why not? What's the difference? Make her glad I'm back with a loving point of view. Not say a word about it. Just grab it and do it. Take care of whatever's to be handled there. And let her know I gained another level of appreciation for her. This lady I'm with is quite a remarkable lady. A couple of months ago, we had one of those rare Saturdays where there was an open day. And we woke up and we were chatting, and she said, what do you want to do today? And I hadn't even thought about it. I said, gee, I don't know. What do you think we ought to do? She said, let's give up an old idea. I went, what? What? She said, yeah, let's give up an old idea. I said, because I'm a good AA. I said, okay. And she said, good, you go first. And I, this sort of the gauntlet had been thrown down, and I had been thinking about something very interesting. I had been thinking, you know, in this book there's phrases that I've come to take literally and kind of push the envelope to see if there's any substance to them. And one of them is, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And I'm thinking, I don't get a sense of constant disclosure. I don't get that. If he's constantly disclosing more to me, I don't feel it. I don't see it. I don't get it. I wonder what that's all about. And as I thought about it, I realized that I have some rules set up about the disclosure and who can make the disclosure. The disclosure has almost always come through human beings. And I got a lot of rules around that. The guys I sponsor, they don't get to disclose to me. My wife, no. The secretaries in the office, no. My partner, John, yeah, maybe. My sponsor, yeah, for between 3 and 4 p.m. on alternate Tuesdays. If he catches me just right, I'll open up my head. But the disclosures are coming in constantly, and so we were laughing about that because I've got all these rules that block the disclosures coming in. I don't want, the disclosure does not come from the elevator operator, does not come from the guy in the next lane. No. The idea that somebody would disclose to me that I'm acting impatiently or rude or driving inappropriately. And yet, it's an old idea. It's the notion that I get to pick and choose, that I can somehow control the manner in which the information comes in, the disclosures come in. And when I looked at that, I realized that's such an interesting old idea. But it really limits. It really limits the disclosures. And I decided to drop the idea that I can set the rules about the disclosures. And It has been very abundant since then. I've got a lot of disclosures. Some of them I didn't want at all, of course. But you kind of get a little neutral about it. You kind of go, wow, that's interesting. Look at that disclosure. Look at that. That person didn't even know they were making a disclosure to me, and they did. It's all, I think, part of step 10, which is it talks about effective living. We need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I mean, if I'm going to set my purpose in the morning, basically when I say direct my thinking at step 11, I have said I want to line up my will with God's will. I just want to get it lined up before I start the day. I want us both to be online. And so I submit to whatever God's will is. I just make that call in the morning. Thy will be done. Direct my thinking. Get me lined up. It's like sailing. I saw some boats out here on the lake yesterday afternoon. That's always a business that's so interesting because you have an aiming point and you're heading out there. And you got a rudder and you have a mainsail and maybe a jib and you are cooking along there. And the current and the wind and the imperfection in the little boat will take you off your point. And you adjust the sail or you adjust the rudder and you come back over in an overcorrection. And I think we spend about 95% of our time off where we want to be. Where it's like a heat-seeking missile, in a sense. There's God's will, and I'm going after it. And that will make a move, and I'll be off over here someplace. There's a constant adjustment. It's akin to this on page 19. It says a sentence that I really was annoyed about, as I was so many of them. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. And there's that word useful again. And then he says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And if you just read that literally, you're going to say, well, I don't have a constant thought of others and my life seems to be going along pretty good. So what's the truth in that statement? But when he uses the word lives, he's probably talking about our lives. He's fond of saying we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension, as you know, is the spiritual dimension. The first dimension is our physical experience and our physical existence. And then the second one would be our intellectual existence. And our third would be emotional existence. And the fourth one would be our spiritual existence. And so my life in all four of those quadrants, in all four of those dimensions, is affected. And it depends upon my constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Well, I knew I didn't have a constant thought of others. I knew that. That's not a big thing to figure out. And I asked about that. I said, you know, this just seems like a kind of almost a silly statement to me. And they said, do you have pretty much a constant sense of gravity? And I said, yeah, I guess I do. I mean, you can't throw your leg out without, you're off balance at that point. And you throw your leg out and you catch yourself and then you throw the next leg out. And any living thing is in motion and off balance. A statue is in perfect balance, but that's not where we play this game. As we move around, we're always off balance. We're always off the point. And we want to stay close to that, and we want to stay close to balance. And we always must take into account the law of gravity. I can't sit down in this chair without flexing and relaxing a series of muscles in rapid, rapid order just to make sure that I sit. I like that. Incidentally, that, you know, those buttons you push to keep the shower going? Well, the gal that's supposed to do that for you didn't show up this morning. No extra charge for that. I'm just telling that. Can you imagine on the tape, they're going to go, what? I was in a meeting one time and the tape broke, and so I stopped talking, and the guy got the tape going again, and as soon as he did, I said, and that's how I earned $1 million my first week of sobriety. He goes, what'd he say? I don't know why they don't like me, do you? If I'm driving, you and I are in the car and we're talking, we got a pretty interesting conversation going. Nonetheless, I have a more or less constant sense of a lot of things other than the conversation. I have a sense of the dashboard lights. I have a sense of my speed. I have a sense of other traffic. I have a sense of the sound of the engine. I have a sense of the sound of the wind. So I need, you know, pick up. We're constantly aware of all of that stuff at a different level. And they told me that that was it. Just a constant low-grade sense of other people and how I may help meet their needs. It makes me more useful. My sponsor has been a remarkable example to me over the years about that. I remember years ago, and I haven't told this story in a long time, years ago when he first went to the Midnight Mission to run it, I guess he'd been my sponsor for 3 or 4 or 5 years maybe. And he was down there for a little bit, and he said to a couple of us, me and Byron and Jim Shaw and a couple of guys that were on the scene in those days, he said, next Sunday night, if you get a chance and want to come by the mission, come on down there, because there's a one of the Los Angeles Rams was arrested in the airport recently for pot, and he went through the, and for another problem that he had, he went through the court system, and they assigned him to do community service. And as it turns out, he's going to come down and do community service by putting on an NFL film here at the mission next Sunday night and then answering questions that the guys in the mission might want to ask. Now, we were all interested in that. This is a wide receiver for the Los Angeles Rams, and an interesting chance to see him up close and stuff. We all showed up there. And he came in, and he had his equipment and all of that stuff, and he's under this court order to do it. And we're sitting back in Clancy's office, and he came in. He got there a little bit late, but he came in, and he went out, and he put on the NFL film, and we all sat and watched that, and then he answered questions of these guys. And they were all sober, these guys, and they asked bright, interesting, intelligent questions. And he wasn't real good with the questions, but... that period passed, and now we're all back in the office, and he's wrapping up this equipment, and he came back and had Clancy sign off his chit. And Clancy did that, and then he said, Lance said, I'll see you next month. Clancy said, don't come back here. Don't come back here. And we were kind of going, wow. He said, what do you mean? I'm ordered to come back here. He said, I don't have to have you back here. You go make another deal with the judge. He said, why? This is a big guy. He said, because you're so disrespectful of these men here that I'm not going for it. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, first of all, you showed up late. They were sitting out there. And by the time you got this thing wound up, it was 20 minutes past the hour when you were supposed to start. That's disrespectful. They were waiting for you. And you show up late. How busy are you? And then after the film was on, and after it was off, and you were asked those questions, you were so dismissive of these men. These are bright men. They're sober men. And they were respectful of you, and they'd ask you a question, and you would dismiss the question with some curt response. He said, don't ever come back here again. And we went, oh. And he said, I got to come back. I don't want to go back to that judge and tell him I can't do this. It'll take him another 6 months to find me something to do, or else I'll go sit in jail for a little bit. And they talked, and we're just kind of like pigeons on a fence watching all of this. Clancy finally said, I'll give you one more shot at it. But he said, I just want you to remember, these men may have given away their dignity at some time along the way. We don't ever take their dignity. Ever. Well, we were all down there the next month, I can tell you that. We wanted to see volume two. Man, he was he was early. And when it came time to answer questions, you would have thought he was talking to the board of directors of the Rams organization. It was stunning to watch that. And it was stunning only because the men weren't, you know, most of the guys were replaced by other guys. They didn't know this is volume two of a drama. But the guy that got, I got it. But the other guy that got it was Lance. He got it big time. I would doubt that he's forgotten it by now. I would think it comes into his mind from time to time. And Clancy wasn't coming off of it a millimeter, not one millimeter. And I really got that. Constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Now, he wasn't talking about solving problems. This doesn't say how we may solve their problems. This is about how we may help meet their needs. And we got to look and have a low-grade appreciation for people around us, where they are and what their needs might be. And take a look. And intuitive thought will give us, what's the need? What's the need here? It's not our business to solve problems. Sometimes we do that. Sometimes we loan money or provide a place for somebody to stay. But what's the real need? The need may very well be, get your own place pulled together. Get a job, get a day job, and work out these details yourself, and I'll see you at the meeting. And it may sound harsh, but maybe that's meeting his need in the sweetest way we possibly can. Another way that it comes up in my home is that Linda will come, we'll be having dinner or something, and she'll be upset because she and the tailor had a little go-round that day. Or somebody at the grocery store, or whatever. And she's mad about the way their exchange went. And she'll tell me this story. And then they said this, and I said that, and I got charged double. And I'll get upset. I'll say, well, did you tell them this? Did you tell them that? Well, you should have mentioned this. You know, when you get into that kind of a jam in the future, you really ought to... And pretty soon it's like, what? See, because I'm trying to solve her problem. Because I think it's my job. I'll sue that son. Did you tell him I'm a lawyer? You know. You can do this because it's not on the... My higher power just spoke to me. What is her need at that moment? And how can I meet it? It's pretty easy. All I have to do is let go of any problem I think I see and say, I can see why you are so annoyed at that guy. Aren't some of them just weird? That's what her need is, to have me say, I understand that. I understand how annoyed you are. And give her a hug and move on to the next event. It's sort of like, don't fix it, donkey, just get it. That's all. That's all. And that's an important part of living effectively. The subtleties of life are what life is all about. It's the subtleties. that we want to wake up to, and that we've always kind of not noticed. And it's the subtleties of life that make us or break us. It's just like when somebody says to me, how are you? Really, they're asking, how are the sum total of your relationships in your life? That's the question. And I say, fine, fine. But it's just an automatic response unless I think about it a minute. How am I? How is my life? How are my relationships with the people around me, the people I should be respecting and loving and caring for? How are those? How are the subtleties of each of those? You know, you can do a lot of damage and a lot of comforting with a tone, with a tone. And we all know the tones because we've all heard. You know how we know which tones hurt? Because they hurt us when we were kids and we heard them. And we just somehow don't forget that. We fall in love with a woman. We try to find everything about her. And along the way, we find out what annoys her, and we carefully keep that in the back here someplace so we can bring out the stiletto on occasion, defend ourselves, poke that ice pick in there. Effective living is about, and I'm saying this because in step 10 it says, our purpose is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And effectiveness. And we've done a lot of work if we've come to step 10. We have an amazing amount of work done. We've looked at ourselves and solved problems with other people and made amends and done a lot of stuff. And of course, the amends process is usually not over by the time we take a look and start living by step 10. One of the most remarkable examples of effective living, of staying on track, of getting off and then coming on, I watched a few years ago, and I know you'll know what I mean when I tell you this. There was a Major League Basketball player, one of the Lakers, and he one day took a huge hit. He got a little note back from the insurance company that he was HIV positive. Now, that hugely impacted his game, his relationship with his players, with the Lakers, with his... can you imagine what a sponsor on a big ad would do with that? With his family, he had a relatively fresh marriage and a little boy. Every area of his life is hit in a major, major way with a little note from the insurance company. I would guess that almost 90% of the athletes, and I know that most of us, would have tried to hide that as long as we could, just as an economic matter. I think I can keep this secret for 6 months and I'll grab every nickel from every endorsement I can. In the meantime, I'll start demanding upfront money. I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll play as well as I can until I... And I'm sure those thoughts must have gone through Magic's mind. I won't even tell my wife, I'm not going to talk about this. But what did he do within about 24 hours? He called a press conference. He said, well, I'm HIV positive. What can I do for you? Now, that's effective living, because we're all going to take the hits, some of them very painful, some of them devastating. And how far off the aiming point am I going to go before I come back? He went off a day, and he's back. He plays ball. He played ball like he lives a spiritual life to me. I mean, that's it. What just was his energy. I see him over there in the morning where I work out, and he's quite a guy. I see that he's involved in an awful lot of projects for people in the black community. I see that he's, and making money too, incidentally. He doesn't think it's cool to not make money on those things. And it's not cool. It's not cool. But it's just an example, and we've all seen examples of that, of people in AA that became very ill and really took seriously the idea that when we're served up with some calamity, if we return to this spiritual life that we have been given so generously, we really can meet that calamity with a sense of serenity. Just to the extent that we're doing what we believe that God would have us do, yeah, get back to that aiming point. And so step 10, is a remarkable way of having the kind of situation with us that can make a huge, huge difference. We are going to... there's a couple of other things that I wanted to discuss with you on step 10. The idea is to keep it cleaned up. Keep it cleaned up. To keep on that aiming point. Continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Vigorously. Vigorously. The words are wonderful because it means energetically commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This continues for our lifetime. We continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What we have done now, the word promptly is used in the book for the first time. Promptly. And the power that we've tapped into gives new meaning to the need for promptly. Promptly. Because we're moving with power now, and we're moving rapidly, and we're moving more effectively than we've ever moved in our lives. And we will bump into people. We will cause hurt feelings. We will cheat and go, God, what happened? And clean that up. Those little embarrassing things we hoped we would never see again have just come back. And they teach us that we'll always be human. Love and tolerance of others is our code. This is the place where he says, every day is a day when we must carry the visions of God's will into all of our activities. And we talked yesterday at step two about forming a vision of God's will, forming a vision of what he would have for us. And they used the springboard of the bedevilments on page 52. I was having trouble with personal relationships and so on. And what would that look like? And that's not a bad vision to carry into the day. I have on my desk a copy of what I wrote down that time, and I'll go down that. Am I carrying this into the day? Is this something I want to carry into the day? We come to develop what he calls a vital sixth sense. This business is called intuitive thought or a sixth sense. And we really tend to dismiss this. And it's a very important thing to have going on. Very important. The thing that has to be kind of out of the way is my ego. My ego is coming in here trying to keep under control all the things that are going to take me into unfamiliar territory. Anything out beyond my belief system, my ego just says, stay away from that. Be careful. Don't go there. Don't do this. You know you've got to fight. You've got to be right. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. And on this side is intuitive thought coming in. And it comes in light, low volume, steady, incredibly sweet, very fresh, and my ego overrides it, and it will not compete with my ego. It doesn't compete any more with my ego than the moon does with the dogs that bark at it. I mean, what would the moon do with the dogs that bark at it? No, it just keeps on being the moon. The dogs are of little consequence to the moon. And the intuitive thought is like that. A few years ago, I had a remarkable experience. I'm in court, and you know in court you can't do that. You got to get in there and fight and win. And I get so prepared and so amped up, and I go in there, and I'm just into my trial book and into my head, and sometimes I'm so busy with what the next question is going to be, I don't hear the answer to the one I just asked. I lose the impact of the jury, and I lose the energy of the judge, and I don't know what's going on, and I'm all up here in my head. And I've learned that my best posture in a courtroom is to be in the room, 100%. And I'm in that room, in that courtroom one day, representing one of the cities in Southern California. There were two other parties. One was a police officer, a motor officer, that had been hit by a guy driving a Mercedes, and the third party was a guy driving the Mercedes. And the guy driving the Mercedes was a arrogant guy. He's never done anything wrong in his life, ever. Not ever. So he was fun to be around. I enjoyed him a lot. And his attorney was kind of in the same category. And so I was there with the city that had hired the guy, that paid out a lot of money to get this motor officer back in uniform again. And the judge was determined that he was going to keep us there all day if it would settle the case, because he didn't want to go through the three-week trial that was going to have to follow. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at this motorcycle officer, who I liked. His leg had been shattered. He's never going to drive a motorcycle in uniform again. And he loved that duty. And his attorney, the cop's attorney, was there. And the Mercedes driver and his attorney. And the insurance guy with the money. And the case was worth a lot of money. And the city, my client, had spent a lot of money to put this guy back together again. And they wanted their money back. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to love these people. I'm going to love every one of them here. And I looked at that cop, and I loved him. I was loving him. I was just thinking, man, that must be shattering. A young guy, 35, something like that, been on the force a while, had a few years to go. Loved driving motorcycles. And he wasn't going to do that anymore. He's on a desk now. And I began to get some compassion for him. And I looked at his attorney, who was kind of greedy. He wanted a fee out of the deal. He was more interested than that. I looked at the guy driving the Mercedes and his stony face. I loved him. I loved his attorney. I loved him. I loved him. And I loved the insurance guy with the money. I really loved him.
Loved him.
Finally, I went over there after a few minutes, and I said to the cop, I said, I want to talk to you. His attorney was right there. I said, I want to talk to you. The attorney said, we can't do that. I said, I want to talk to both of you. Let's go out in the hall. And we went out in the hall, and I sat down with the cop and with his attorney and a little bench along there, and I sort of talked past the, I said to the police officer, I said, what do you want? What do you want from this case? You're not going to get your leg back. You're not going to get your job back. You're not going to get your hazardous duty pay back. What do you want? What would seem fair to you? The only thing they can do is give you money. What's the number? And he had never really talked about that with anybody before, and nobody had ever said to him, here's the deal. They can't go make that guy driving the Mercedes take off a leg and give it to you. You can't do that. The only deal you got is money. What's the number? What would seem fair? And he finally threw out a number, and I said, you can't have that. The jury will not give you that number. And even if they gave you something like that, your attorney would take his fee, and the costs and all of that stuff would go on. I said, the jury will probably come back with a number about like this, and I gave him the number. And I said, and even then, here's what's going to come off the top. Really, what we want to know is what you want to put in your bank account, what you think would be fair. Fortunately, there was a lot of insurance on this Mercedes. And we talked at some length, and I talked to him in a way that I really felt. And he got it, that I felt his loss. And I felt his sense of, there's not enough money in the world. You know what I'm saying to you? There's not enough money in the world. I know, but that's all that you can get. That's it. That's all that the system allows you to have. And we finally came up with a number. And it was sure more than they wanted to pay. And I would have to add to that what the city had spent. And I checked it with his attorney, who he's going to lie. He had never talked to the guy like this. But now we had a number. And I went over to the attorney that represented the donkey and the Mercedes. And did I say donkey? Yes. Yeah, loving that donkey. Yeah, right. And I asked him, because it wasn't really his money, it was insurance money, but I said, do you want to go through a 3-week trial here? He said, I really don't. I don't have time for that. And I commiserated with him. What occurred to me to say is, well, you had plenty of time to almost kill a cop. But I didn't say that, and I don't judge. I think you've learned that about me by now. But I did say, I understand exactly how you feel. Because this isn't what you do for a living. This is what we do for a living. And you need to get about your business. Because he was a high earner. And I said, what you need to do is get with the idea of settling this case. Because the truth of the matter is, whether you like it or not, the jury is going to find you responsible for the injuries to the police officer. And all your squirming and kicking and ranting and raving isn't going to change that. They're going to nail you. The jury is going to come back with a verdict against you for that accident. They will not believe your testimony about the light changing suddenly and all of that hot comedy that you've come up with. And he's kind of looking at me. And I go, but I get their general agreement that they don't want a trial. And I go over and I sit down with the insurance guy who's sitting there stony-faced, and he's not going to budge, and he's not going to do this and that. And I paint him a little bit of picture, but I'm loving the guy. I'm loving the guy. And I loved him and talked to him and laughed with him. And I've been in his position many times where I'm on the defense of a case and I've got the insurance guy in my hip pocket. And we talked and we met each other on other cases and stuff. And I said, you know, this could be a runaway case. The jury's going to like that cop. And they're not going to like your insured over there. They're not going to like this arrogant guy. They're not going to like him. And the more he screams and wiggles and carries on and refuses to admit he was responsible, the more they're going to bang him. And you need to really open up that purse just a little more and get us some money here. Well, we went around a little bit more, but by the end of the day, by 4 o'clock, I called my client, the city, and I talked to the deputy mayor over there, and I said, we got the case settled, and we got it settled at a good figure, and we put it on the record, and it's all over. And he said, God, that's wonderful. He said, did you get some money back for the city? I said, I got every nickel that you spent. He said, my God, how did you do that? And I didn't want to tell him, well, I'm just loving people today. So I say, I don't know what I said. Well, that's what you hired me to do or something like that. But it's effective living. It's growing in understanding and effectiveness. It's step 10. It's a huge chance to take in the middle of a courtroom scene to just begin loving people. But if it works there, it'll work anywhere. It even works at home. Although I hesitate to suggest that you actually love people in your own home. That could be dangerous. They won't recognize who... No, I'm kidding. They'll they respond very well. Let's take a break and come back in a few minutes. 12 and 12. To a certain extent, Wilson gets into the business of forgiveness. And the whole point of step 8 is forgiveness. And he doesn't really say much about how to do it, either in the 12 and 12 or in the big book. And what he says is, among other things, as we go into step 9, we're about to ask forgiveness for ourselves. Why shouldn't we start out by forgiving them, one and all? And we slam right through that. Another place in step 8, he says, these obstacles, however, are very real, the obstacles that we... Step 9. The first and one of the most difficult has to do with forgiveness. The moment we ponder a twisted or broken relationship with another person, our emotions go on the defensive. To escape looking at the wrongs we have done another, we resentfully focus on the wrongs he has done us. This is especially true if he has, in fact, behaved badly at all. Triumphantly, we seize upon his misbehavior as the perfect excuse for minimizing or forgetting our own. And his antidote to this is forgiveness. And forgiveness is an extraordinarily powerful thing. A few years ago, a good friend of mine brought me back in touch with a writer in the 30s in New York by the name of Emmett Fox. Wilson really loved Emmett Fox and had had a lot of contact with him. And he was a very effective human being. And he wrote, among other things, a book called The Sermon on the Mount. And in The Sermon on the Mount, he dissects the Lord's Prayer. At the end of that book, Sermon on the Mount, he takes a look at the Sermon on, but he also takes a look at the Lord's Prayer. And he takes each of the seven clauses of the Lord's Prayer and takes that apart. I was reading this. I took this book with me on the airplane to go someplace, and on the way back on a Sunday afternoon, I'm in the airplane, and I just happened to open this to the Sermon on the Mount and to the Lord's Prayer, and I read the part in the Lord's Prayer that had to do with forgiveness. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And he does a very remarkable job there, and I realized, notwithstanding the fact that my amends were completed, notwithstanding the fact that I had done all this work on myself, I realized as I sat there in that airplane and read what he had to say about forgiveness that I was still suffering from the fact that I had not forgiven. I had not forgiven. It didn't seem to me, it hadn't really come up in a sharp way during the process of the steps. And I read what he had to say about it. And I read what he had to say about how to do forgiveness. And I read what he had to say about the price of not doing this simple act of forgiveness. And I made a list of the people that I had yet to forgive. I just wrote it down on a piece of paper on that airplane. And before that airplane landed, I had gone through this act of forgiveness as to each of those 10 people. There were 10 of them. And I can't tell you how I lightened up in my thinking about these people. Because I just had never let them off the hook. And this is a remarkably effective thing. I do this in my home, in my marriage, because my wife loves me very much, and I love her very much. But we step on each other's toes. She corrected me in front of people a month ago. I remember feeling really hurt about it because the truth of the matter was I wasn't being clean with what I told them about some certain thing. Friends of ours, and I was embellishing some story so I looked better. And she corrected me. And she didn't do it out of any venom. She just said, oh, no, you know, that wasn't quite... And man, she just blew my covers, you know. And did it really without any kind of anything on it, as far as I could tell. But boy, I wanted to punish her for that. You know? And instead, I forgave her for that. I just let it go. A few years ago, I was with somebody, and I learned it here. That I was with a gal, this is some time ago, but I was with a gal, and I was raising that boy with her, and we all lived together, and we bought a puppy. And I woke up one Sunday morning and let the pup out the back door. And then I called him in, and I went out to get the paper, and I put some coffee on, and Daniel, the little boy, and Cindy are both sleeping in their bedrooms, and I walked past the den, and I saw the pup had peed on the carpet in the den, and I became unreasoningly angry. God, I was just furious. I had let him out and brought him in. He's supposed to pee out there, you know, and he's deliberately defying me, you know. It's just, it makes no sense, but that's where my mind took it. Not a pretty picture. I grabbed that pup, beautiful little pup, maybe 3 months old, friendly and loving and high energy, and I grabbed him, and I was so mad, and I'm holding him too tight, and I'm walking him out the back door, back of the house, and I don't know what I expected to do with him in the back now, because he's all done with whatever he's done. But I got to the back door, and the pup got frightened. And he's going, arr, arr, arr. And I'm just thinking, oh, I felt like an axe murderer, you know, going back there with this thing. But I'm so mad I can't come off of it. And I opened the back door, and I threw the pup out on the back there, and he rolled over three times. And he jumps up, and he goes, you know, what the game, next game is going to be, and I'm still mad, and I slam the door, and I sit down there, and then the guilt, that terrible guilt sets in. God, it's back to the mountaintop. I haven't made a damn bit of progress in all of this work and all of that stuff, and upset Cindy because she loved that puppy, and I upset Daniel because, you know, and I just knew that that kid's laying in bed with these big eyes, and Cindy is in there. And I had a cup of coffee, and I read the paper for a little bit, mostly just kind of looked at the paper. And then I went outside, and I sat down with the puppy, and I loved it and did all of that. And, of course, puppies are, he was cool with it. I mean, he was fine. But and then I knew I had to go in the bedroom where Cindy was. And she was sitting up, and she was reading something that she reads in the morning. And she looked up, and she gave me the most wonderful smile. I couldn't believe it. She just gave me a smile, and she patted the bed, the side of the bed, and I went over and sat down by her, and she put her arm around me, and she just held me. She forgave me. That never came up again. She could have flogged me around the fleet. She could have had me for lunch for 6 weeks for that. Because, I mean, I had really hit them where they lived with that thing with the puppy. And I felt bad. I just felt so bad. And she loved me and forgave it. She let it go. And it never came up. And I've never forgotten it. And that relationship is long over. But it has given me an example in my mind of what real effectiveness can be in a day-to-day situation. And so I think it's important that we take a look at it. I'm taking a big chance with you because we're going outside of the conference-approved literature, but this is what he has to say in Sermon on the Mount under the Lord's Prayer. He says, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us." This clause is the turning point of the prayer. It is the strategic key to the whole treatment. And he uses language that we wouldn't necessarily use, and I'm just going to read the language that he uses. Let us notice here that Jesus has so arranged this marvelous prayer that it covers the entire ground of the unfoldment of our souls completely and in the most concise and telling way. It omits nothing that is essential for our salvation, and yet so compact is it that there is not a thought or a word too much. Every idea fits into its place with perfect harmony and in perfect sequence. Anything more would be redundance, anything less would be incompleteness, and at this point it takes up the critical factor of forgiveness. Having told us what God is and what man is and how the universe works, how we are to do our own work, the salvation of humanity and of our own souls, he then explains what our true nourishment or supply is and the way in which we can obtain it, and now he comes to the forgiveness of sins. The forgiveness of sins is the central problem of life. Sin is a sense of separation from God and is the major tragedy of human experience. It is, of course, rooted in selfishness. It is essentially an attempt to gain some supposed good to which we are not entitled in justice. It is a sense of isolated, self-regarding personal existence, whereas the truth of being is that all is one. Our true selves are at one with God, undivided from Him, expressing His ideas, witnessing to His nature, the dynamic thinking of that mind. Because we are all one with the great whole of which we are spiritually a part, it follows that we are all one with all men. Just because in Him we live and move and have our being, we are in the absolute sense all essentially one. Evil, sin, the fall of man, in fact, is essentially the attempt to negative this truth in our thoughts. We try to live apart from God. We try to do without Him. We act as though we had a life of our own, as separate minds, as though we could have plans and purposes and interests separate from His. All this, if it were true, would mean that existence is not one and harmonious, but a chaos of competition and strife. It would mean that we are quite separate from our fellow man and could injure him, rob him, or hurt him, or even destroy him without any damage to ourselves. And in fact, the more we took from other people, the more we should have for ourselves. It would mean that the more we considered our own interests and the more indifferent we were to the welfare of others, the better off we should be. Of course, it would then follow naturally that it would pay others to treat us in the same way, and that accordingly we might expect many of them to do so. Now, if this were true, it would mean that the whole universe is only a jungle, that sooner or later it must destroy itself by its own inherent weakness and anarchy. But, of course, this is not true, and therein lies the joy of life. Undoubtedly, many people do act as though they believed it to be true, and a great many more who would be dreadfully shocked if brought face to face with that proposition in cold blood have nevertheless a vague feeling that such must very much be the way things are, even though they themselves are personally above consciously acting in accordance with such a notion. Now, this is the real basis of sin, of resentment, of condemnation, of jealousy, of remorse, and all the evil brood that walk that path. This belief in independent and separate existence is the arch sin. And now, before we can progress any further, we have to take the knife to this evil thing and cut it out once and for all. Jesus knew this, and with this definite end in view, he inserted at this critical point a carefully prepared statement that would compass our end and his without the shadow of a possibility of miscarrying. He inserted that what is nothing less than a trip clause. He drafted a declaration which would force us, without any conceivable possibility of escape, evasion, mental reservation, or subterfuge of any kind, to execute the great sacrament of forgiveness, great sacrament of forgiveness in all of its fullness and far-reaching power. As we repeat the great prayer intelligently, considering and meaning what we say, we are suddenly, so to speak, caught up off our feet and grasped as though in a vice, so that we must face this problem. There's no escape. We must positively and definitely extend forgiveness to everyone to whom it is possible that we can owe forgiveness, namely to anyone who we think may have injured us in any way. There's no possibility of glossing over this fundamental thing. That prayer is constructed with more skill than any lawyer displayed in the casting of a deed. He has so contrived it that once our attention has been drawn to this matter, we are inevitably obliged either to forgive our enemies in sincerity and truth or to never again repeat the prayer. It's safe to say that no one who reads this with understanding will ever again be able to use the Lord's Prayer unless and until he has forgiven. Should you now attempt to repeat it without forgiving, it can safely be predicted that you will not be able to finish it. This great central clause will stick in your throat. Notice that he does not say, "Forgive me my trespasses and I will try to forgive others," or "I'll see if it can be done." He obliges us to declare that we have actually forgiven and forgiven all, and he makes our claim to our own forgiveness to depend on that. Who is there who has enough grace to say his prayers at all, who does not long for the forgiveness or cancellation of his own mistakes and faults? Who would be so insane as to endeavor to seek the kingdom of God without desiring to be relieved of his own sense of guilt? No one, we may believe, and so we see that we're trapped in the inescapable position that we cannot demand our own release before we have released our brother. The forgiveness of others is the doorway to heaven, and Jesus knew it and has led us through the door. You must forgive anyone who has ever hurt you if you want to be forgiven yourself. That's the long and the short of it. You have to get rid of all resentment and condemnation of others, and not least of self-condemnation and remorse. You have to forgive others, and having discontinued your own mistakes, you have to accept the forgiveness of God for them too, or you cannot make any progress. You have to forgive yourself, but you cannot forgive yourself sincerely until you have forgiven others first. Having forgiven others, you must be prepared to forgive yourself too, or to refuse to forgive yourself is only spiritual pride. We cannot make this point too clear to ourselves. We've got to forgive. There are few people in the world who have not at some time or another been hurt, really hurt, by someone else, or been disappointed, or injured, or deceived, or misled. Such things sink into the memory where they usually cause inflamed and festering wounds, and there is only one remedy. They have to be plucked out and thrown away. And the one and only way to do that is by forgiveness. Of course, nothing in all the world is easier to forgive people who have not hurt us very much. Nothing is easier than to rise above the thought of a trifling loss. Anyone will be willing to do this. But what this law requires of us is that we forgive not only these trifles, but the very things that are so hard to forgive that at first it seems impossible to do it at all. The despairing heart cries, "It is too much to ask. That thing meant too much to me. It is impossible. I cannot forgive it." But the Lord's Prayer makes our own forgiveness from God, which means our escape from guilt and limitation, dependent upon just this very thing. There is no escape from this, and so forgiveness there must be, no matter how deeply we may have been injured, how terribly we may have suffered. It must be done. If your prayers are not being answered, search your consciousness and see if there's not someone you have yet to forgive. Find out if there's not some old thing about which you are very resentful. Search and see if you're not really holding a grudge. It may be camouflaged in some self-righteous way against an individual, some body of people, a nation, a race, a social class, some religious movement of which you disapprove, perhaps a political party or whatnot. If you are doing so, then you have an act of forgiveness to perform, and when this is done, you will probably make your demonstration. If you cannot forgive at present, you'll have to wait to have your prayers answered until you can, and you'll have to postpone finishing your recital of the Lord's Prayer too, or involve yourself in the position that you do not desire the forgiveness of God. Setting others free means setting yourself free, because resentment is really a form of attachment. It takes two to make a prisoner, the prisoner and his jailer. There's no such thing as being a prisoner on one's own account. Every prisoner has a jailer, and the jailer is as much a prisoner as his charge. When you hold resentment against anyone, you're bound to that person by a cosmic link, a real though mental chain. You're tied by a cosmic tie to the thing you hate. The one person, perhaps in the whole world, whom you most dislike is the very one to whom you are attaching yourself by a hook that is stronger than steel. Is this what you wish? Is this the condition in which you desire to go on living? Remember, you belong to the thing with which you're linked in thought, and at some time or another, if that tie endures, the object of your resentment will be drawn back into your life to create perhaps further difficulty for you. Do you think you can afford this? Of course, no one can afford such a thing, and so the way is clear. You must cut all such ties by a clear and spiritual act of forgiveness. Let him go. By forgiveness, you set yourself free, you save your soul, and because the law of love works alike for one and all, you help save his soul too, making it just so much easier for him to become what he ought to be. But how, in the name of all that is wise and good, is the magic act of forgiveness to be accomplished when we've been so deeply injured that, though we would have long wished with all our hearts that we could forgive, we've nevertheless found it impossible? When we have tried and tried to forgive but have found the task beyond us. The technique of forgiveness is simple enough and not very difficult to manage when you understand how. The only thing that is essential is willingness to forgive. Provided you desire to forgive the offender, the greater part of the work is already done. It's been a big problem with people because they think then they have to like the person, but that's not the way of it at all. We're obliged to love people, to have charity for them, but this has nothing directly to do with feelings, although it is always followed sooner or later by a wonderful feeling of peace and happiness. The method of forgiveness is this. Get by yourself and become quiet. Repeat any prayer that appeals to you or read a chapter of the Bible. Then quietly say, I freely and fully forgive blank. I loose him and I let him go. I completely forgive the whole business in question. As far as I'm concerned, it is finished forever. I cast the burden of resentment upon God within me. That person is free now, and I'm free too. I wish him well in every phase of his life. That incident is finished. The truth has set us both free. Thank God. Then get up and go about your business. On no account repeat this act of forgiveness, because you've done it once and for all, and to do it a second time with the same person would be tacitly to repudiate your own work. Afterward, whenever the memory of the offender or the offense happens to come into your mind, bless the delinquent briefly and dismiss the thought. Do this however many times the thought may come back. After a few days, it will return less and less often until you forget it altogether. Then, perhaps after an interval, shorter or longer, the old trouble may come back to memory once more. But you will find now that all bitterness and resentment have disappeared, and you're both free with the perfect freedom of the children of God. Your forgiveness Your forgiveness is complete. You will experience a wonderful joy in the realization of the demonstration. Everybody should practice a general forgiveness every day as a matter of course. When you say your daily prayers, issue a general amnesty, forgiving everyone who may have injured you in any way. And don't even go into detail. Simply say, I freely forgive everyone. Then in the course of the day, should the thought of grievance or resentment come up, bless the offender briefly and dismiss the thought. The result of this policy will be that very soon you will find yourself cleared of all resentment and condemnation, and the effect upon your happiness, your bodily health, your general life will be nothing less than revolutionary. Often people come up and say, you know, I've made amends to this person, and there's still energy between us, negative energy, and I don't know whether to write another inventory or have another go at him or just what the problem is. And when I've had that experience, and I have, of course, it's about forgiveness. And I would like to take a moment now and ask you to get in mind someone that you have yet to forgive, someone who you have not forgiven. And the clue is even though I may have gone to this person and made amends, even though we seem to be living in relative harmony, is there some tension between us that I just cannot explain? And am I still mad about some of those old hurts? Am I still mad at her because of the insult that she, you know, that I didn't feel I did, whatever it is? And then it's necessary that we become willing to let them off the hook, to let it go, just let it go. And we have to ask for that. Take me to a place where I'm willing, where I'm gladly ready to let them off the hook. Just take me to a place where I'm gladly ready to let them off the hook. And once we're there, and this is 2 minutes, thinking of the person and becoming willing, gladly ready to let them off the hook. And then there is this thing that we can say. I have put it on a little thing up here, and I'll fold it over and we can do that. But take just a few minutes. We're going to do this for about 5 minutes, I think, something like that. Pick up a copy of Sermon on the Mount, or else I have a couple of copies of this one thing that I just read to you up here, if somebody wants to stop by and pick it up. The forgiveness process has become important to me, and perhaps it will become important to you too. It just seems to be the last little element that we need. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is mission. How many of you would be able to articulate what your mission in life is? Okay, got a guy with a mission. Yeah, what is your mission?
To bring health, truth, and happiness to others.
Okay.
To touch as many lives as I can.
Touch as many lives as you can to bring health and happiness to others. All right, to fit myself to be of maximum use to God and to my fellows. How many of you? Yes, sir. To be an example of the truth? Great. Great. We all have, I think, 3 tiers to our mission. And what you've heard expressed is the one tier I want to talk about, but I'll talk about the other two briefly. We've been talking about them all weekend. The first tier that we have to our mission is to be on the best possible relationship with God. Incidentally, what we ought to do is take photographs of these, put them in every 12-step house in the country, and when the new guy comes in, say, look. And if he doesn't get it, throw him out. Here. You get it? Now, do you understand what I'm talking about? If you don't get, yeah, publish it. We can make a million on this. Yeah. Yeah, I get it. It's about money, right? Okay, the first tier is to be on the best possible terms that we can in our relationship with our Creator. The second tier is to be on the best possible terms with our fellow man. And the third tier is personal. Each of us has the first two in common. We all have those as our mission. Now, the third tier, the third level of a mission, is one that we have to acquire for ourselves. I don't know why, but I always had the idea that somebody might lead me to the top of the mountain and say, Clint, there's the distant city. Go out there and stamp out alcoholism. That's your mission in life. Nobody's ever done that. But I saw something that really interested me. This guy said that our individual mission, and you've heard him expressed very well here today, our individual mission is located at the point where the talent we most love using meets the needs of the world around us. Where the talent we most love using meets the needs of the world around us. And the test for the talent that we most love using is if we're engaged in that talent, we lose track of the passage of time. Not that talent. No, I'm kidding. But it's what we're engrossed in so much that when we're doing it, we lose track of the passage of time. Can you get in mind something that you just love to do so much that when you're involved in it, time becomes not a factor? There should get to be a certain timelessness to that, to our activity, if it's what we most love using. And then all we have to do is figure out where that activity meets the needs of the world around us. And that's our mission. And I don't think there's any better evidence of a loving God than one that would construct a universe such that I get to have as a mission doing something I really love to do. With some people, it's music. And they set it aside because they think, it's not a real... Yeah. With some people, it's whatever it is. You know, each of us has talents that we really, really love to use. And they've probably been with us since childhood in a way. The things that caught us up, the things that we just were so intrigued by and in love with that we need to be doing that. Because that's what we're going to do the very best. And that's what's going to really bring us not just income, and that will be abundant, but joy. And be very useful to the people around us. That's our mission. That's our mission. And we want to... You can walk down any street in the country and ask 100 people, what's your mission? And we really want to know the answer to that. I thought long and hard about that. Hard about what do I really, really love doing? And what do I... And when I realized what it was, I realized I love doing it in every area of my life. Whether I'm talking to a jury or taking a guy through the steps or making a 12-step call or drafting a legal brief or writing an appellate brief or talking to a client or to a judge or just... hanging out. But you know what I love to do? I love to bring clarity out of chaos. That's what I like to do. That's what I like to do. It boils down to that. You say, well, I like to write a legal brief that's really crisp and great. But it's about bringing the broader... And I do it at home. I do it at home. I want my wife to have real clarity about how I see our relationship and how much I love her. I want her to be clear what my priorities are so she doesn't have to wonder what I'm up to, how I'm really feeling. I don't hide it because it's such a gift to bring clarity out of chaos. And so the mission always meets, the mission is the point at which the talent I most love using meets the needs of the world around me. So we want to take into account, how does that affect people around me and where can I use it so I'm useful? And so I articulate my mission as being to bring clarity out of chaos so others can have peace. So others can have peace. That's useful. That's useful. And when I'm engaged in that, it means a lot to me. Brings me great, great joy, great sense of happiness. Whatever arena I'm doing it, sometimes it's with humor, often with humor. I mean, we heard some stuff in the meeting last night that was remarkably, remarkably funny, and yet the people that were articulating it were bringing a lot of clarity out of chaos. We learned from the articulation of that. And so humor can be a wonderfully effective way to bring clarity out of chaos. Take a look at the talent you most love using, the one that God gave you that really thrills you to use it. And see where it meets the needs of the world around you. And go there. And the rewards will be quite amazing. And you'll be very effective. And you'll know why you're on this earth. And you'll know what the sweet life is all about. And we need to know that because we're here for a purpose. And we better discover it as soon as we can. I mean, we were given that remarkable, amazing grace that brought us safely here. After all our kicking and screaming, it brought us safely here. And it will take us home. And that trip home can be kind of one that we're all stumbling around, bumping into walls, or where we can have a purpose, where we can have a mission, where we can have an appreciation for the sweetness of this life and all of its ramifications. And you know what? This weekend you have really given me another look at my mission, my purpose, the sweetness of this life. I've enjoyed this time with you very, very much. And I want to thank you for including me. Have a good weekend.